Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Wellness Wednesday. Even if you accept its dangers and are willing to kick the habit or addiction by the measure of some, escaping sugar is harder than it sounds in this day and age. Good luck finding packaged and processed foods without it. Everything from salad dressing to bread is laced with added sugars, and my first guest says it's ruining our bodies. The good news is there are ways out, and registered dietitian Brooke Alpert is here to tell us about one. Brooke is co-author of the book, The Sugar Detox, and she joins us from New York. Welcome to the show, Brooke.
Thank you for having me.
The book treats sugar very much as a drug, and the detox program begins with 3 absolutely sugar-free days. It's sort of like cold turkey. What's the strategy there? You're treating it like a drug.
Well, sugar is a drug, and scientists out in California actually were trying to get sugar regulated the same way that alcohol and tobacco are. So it truly does have drug-like qualities. That said, in the sugar detox, we do a 3-day cold turkey program to start to break the cycle. It's so easy for people to keep reaching for more and more, so how do we stop? And what we found with over 80 testers, that by going cold turkey worked the best. And the great thing is it's just 3 days. You can do anything for 3 days. I mean, we can live without food for 3 days, so you can go without sugar for 3 days.
Now, 30-odd years ago when I quit smoking, they said you had to quit for 2 weeks. You had to get through a 2-week period. What's the magic of 3 days for sugar?
Well, the thing about, sugar is that you're going to need to eat. You can choose never to have a cigarette again, but you're going to need food again, and it's likely there will be sugar.
Okay.
That said, the great thing about the 3 days is what we found in our testers was that after those 3 days, people's palates got recalibrated. So from being bombarded so much with all the sugar that everyone was eating, after the 3 days, they kind of were back at square one, where they could taste natural sweetness in foods like almonds or onions or even an apple, though they tasted that what true sweetness was versus this overly sweet world we'd been living in.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Wellness Wednesday. We're talking about sugar as a drug. My guest is Brooke Alpert. She's a co-author of a new book. It's called The Sugar Detox. If you have a question or comment, or if you just want to admit that you're an addict, because I will admit I'm an addict, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Are lots of people addicts?
I think lots of people are addicts, and a lot of people fool themselves into thinking they're not addicts. So people say, oh, well, I don't have a sweet tooth, but yet they're the ones that are overeating white rice and white pastas and white bread, or I only drink diet soda, therefore I'm not consuming real sugar. It's all addictive behavior, regardless of how you're ingesting sugar. It's all sugar, no matter what.
What happens, or does anything particular happen besides just cleaning the slate? Does anything happen to your body during that withdrawal from sugar like it does from withdrawal from a drug?
Absolutely. It really depending on how addicted your sugar addiction is.
I don't want to get into it personally, but
we'll keep it personal.
Give me a general. Yeah.
But really, depending on how strong your addiction is, we had some people that complained of crankiness, some fogginess, not such great energy those first 3 days. We even had some people that had real withdrawal symptoms, like the shakes, the sweats. It really, depending on how severe your addiction is, will be how severe your withdrawal is. That said, by day 4, when we reincorporate some natural sugars back in, like a natural source of dairy and fruit and red wine, people were able to really start feeling better immediately. So even before we brought in the natural sugars, by day 3, people started seeing, this is my life and my brain without sugar. How amazing.
It seems like there are so many ways to describe sugar nowadays. It's not just the stuff in the canister, on your counter or in your cupboard. It's many, many more things. Tell us about some of the disguises of sugar.
Sugar is so sneaky, and it just pops up everywhere, and it has different disguises like hats and wigs on. And basically, sugar can be found as the regular white granulated stuff we know. It can be found as honey. It can be found listed as cane syrup. It can be listed as brown rice syrup. It could be listed as agave, and or artificial sweeteners. It could be listed as aspartame, saccharin, so many different things, which is why we want all of our readers, I want all of my clients in my private practice, to read ingredients. Nothing is more important than reading the ingredients, because you'll see it written plain and clear.
Well, you say that plain and clear, but some of it's written in language I do not understand. Agave, I understand. Something, you know, those long $10 words, I don't.
Right. Well, number one, if you're seeing those long $10 words, likely you shouldn't be eating it anyway.
There's probably sugar in it somewhere.
There's probably sugar. And if it's not sugar, there's something else that's bad for
okay.
you. Right?
Yep.
Like when you read, you know, the package of good quality bread, you should be able to understand all the ingredients that are in there. If you need a dictionary or to like sound things out, it's likely not a good quality bread for you.
That 3-day detox, that includes no fruit, right?
We do no fruit as well. Americans are eating too much fruit in general. Fruit is great in that it has vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, the works. The problem is that what it does is still engage that addictive behavior. So just because we're opting for a healthier version of sugar doesn't mean that our body's taking it in much healthier. So by taking even the natural fruit, natural sugars and fruit out, you still are going to get a real cleanse those first 3 days, which then makes you appreciate the natural sugars you'll get starting the first day of week one.
So it's only for the detox. You're not down on natural fruits.
No, but we do watch our portion sizes.
Uh-huh.
It's amazing. I have clients that come into my office. They're like, I can't lose weight. And I see they're eating buckets of pineapple or, you know, 2 bananas a day. And it's just too much fruit because that means too much sugar in your body.
How does exercise come into play? Does it matter if you exercise?
Absolutely. You knew I couldn't get away with
so
that.
So I can
one.
Eat
Absolutely.
More sugar if I exercise.
No, it doesn't mean you can eat more sugar.
Okay.
But we have a very big exercise chapter. We had an amazing trainer come in and really design an exercise chapter for our readers. And this chapter is really special. What we did was we found the best kind of exercises that help with our whole process of trying to lower your blood glucose levels. Certain types of exercises, especially any sort of high-intensity training, really help lower your blood glucose levels. And if we keep our blood sugar levels down, then that means that we're not going to be having the reactions that cause us to store fat and start that, you know, addictive behavior again. So we have an amazing exercise chapter.
So you have the sweet dilemma, which is chapter 3. And it starts out with testing your sugar ID. One of the questions is, which of these foods is hiding the most sugar per half cup serving? Tomato sauce, salsa, or tomato soup? And I wondered, you know, I mean, how did you devise that test? And knowing what you know about how people usually answer those questions, how intelligent, what is our sugar IQ?
We're all pretty dumb. I got to be honest with you. You know, and the thing is really no one is eating tomato sauce thinking they're consuming sugar. No one's consuming a tomato soup or, you know, dipping carrots into salsa thinking, hey, I'm indulging here and I'm having an unhealthy snack. And that's what we want our readers to become, really their own sugar detectives. And if they can do that by reading the ingredients, by making healthy choices, then they're going to be able to make everything worthwhile. We don't want someone wasting their time and eating a great meal, using a great, you know, tomato sauce, and not know that they're swallowing tablespoons of sugar while they're consuming it.
Are there vegetables that have sugar in them?
Absolutely. So basically the way that we judge what is sugar in this book mm-hmm. is how your body breaks it down. What kind of reaction does your body have to it? So some things like a sweet potato or the starchier vegetables, you know, like a white potato, mm-hmm. really act as sugar in your body. Even tomatoes, in the beginning, we don't allow them because it causes a sugar increase in your blood system. They're then allowed after the first 3 days, but in those first 3 days, we really go sugar-free, including certain fruits and vegetables, or all fruits and some vegetables. So even some vegetables we omit, even carrots we don't add back into later.
That's
we never
what spurred
add back
my
in
question.
Corn.
Yeah, I wondered about carrots right off the bat. Yeah, because
they're
sweet.
So they are sweet. And, you know, it's funny. I always tell my clients, no one has to come and sit in my office on my couch because they ate too many carrots. But the point is that because we're going on this real sugar-free lifestyle, we take away all sugar so that we don't trigger anything, so that our body really has a chance to reset. And then we add it back in a gradual, healthy way.
614-292-8513. That's the number to call. There's still a few minutes with Brooke Alpert. She is the co-author of a new book. It's called The Sugar Detox, and she joins us from New York. I suppose then, given the tomato issue, everybody ought to get out and get that detox done before the tomatoes start to ripen.
Yes, I think today is a great day to start the sugar detox. Absolutely.
So what isn't sugar? What do you eat during that 3 days?
The first 3 days, it's really amazing how much food you can eat. And that's what one thing we do in the book is that we talk about everything to eat before we talk about everything not to eat. The way I like to run my practice, and I think it's a more positive way of looking at things. That said, during those first 3 days, you can have all types of lean protein. So anything from tofu to beans, nuts, legumes, to chicken or even beef, fish, seafood, whatever does it for you in that source. You can have tons of green leafy vegetables. There's a whole list of other vegetables you can have as well. You can do cucumbers. You can do red peppers, which are amazing how sweet they are when you haven't had any sugar all day. We do hummus. I mean, really, it's quite unlimited once you get out of the mindset of everything I can't eat and start looking into everything you can eat those 3 days.
Your co-author, Patricia Ferris, is a dermatologist, and I know that the skin is affected by our diet, but the impact of sugar on the skin is pretty dramatic. Tell us about that.
It's amazing. You know, my co-author, Dr. Patty Farris, always tells me that she knows when someone walks into her office, whether they sit in the sun, whether they're a smoker, or whether they eat too much sugar. It all shows in your face. And what sugar does is when we have all this sugar floating around in your bloodstream, it has to attach to something. And it chooses to attach to molecules like collagen and elastin. These are things that we want lots of in our face. These are things people are injecting into our faces, mm-hmm. right? And when sugar attaches to them, it turns these great supple molecules into brittle molecules. And we get sagging, we get drooping, we get dark circles. So sugar really ruins the molecules that cause us to look younger. So therefore, sugar makes us age.
Well, that's a bummer. we have a call right now from Tom in Columbus. You're on the air, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm a diabetic. I've done a fairly good job of controlling my blood sugar. Your guest may understand when I say I have an A1C level of 5.2.
And it
sounds
work.
Well, I used to have problems when my blood glucose level would get down into the 90s, and now I can stroll around and be quite happy with a blood glucose level of 40, but I know that that's really too low, and my doctor and I have battles about that. But anyway, the only comment I really wanted to make was it sounds like when you're saying people have withdrawal from sugar during the first 3 days. That's just sugar lows, isn't it?
It is sugar lows. The thing is, this diet is not meant for anyone who is an insulin-dependent diabetic or taking any sort of medications, whether you're type 1 or type 2. That all needs to go through your doctor. What we're talking about is people who are actually missing and having an addictive behavior to sugar. Not that their sugar is crashing. They have more than enough calories to keep them going those 3 days. They are actually having withdrawal symptoms, not low blood sugar. There's
okay.
a difference.
All right, Tom. Thank you for that call. And then real quick, John in Reynoldsburg, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Hey, I really need to know. I have fruit smoothies every morning, and I throw a ton of fruit in there. Can that contribute to my knee and leg pain if I've got mild arthritis? I'm a long-distance runner, and since I've been doing my fruit smoothies, I've been experiencing a lot of pain. Any relation?
Absolutely. So too much fruit can really cause an inflammatory reaction in your body. So just like too much sugar, too much fruit as well. If I were you, what I would do is I would lower the amount of fruit you're eating, throw in some green leafy vegetables, and then add in a spice called turmeric. That's something you can find in a lot of Indian cooking, you know, that bright orange spice. That's a natural anti-inflammatory. Start small, otherwise you'll have like a, you know, a curry smoothie, which isn't the best tasting thing. Add a little bit of turmeric in the beginning, get used to the taste, cut down the amount of fruit you're going to have. You'll be reducing the amount of sugar while adding more anti-inflammatory benefits.
All right. Thank you, John, for that call. We appreciate it. And thank you, Brooke Alpert, for joining us today. It's been interesting.
Been my pleasure.
Brooke Alpert, she is the co-author of The Sugar Detox, Lose Weight, Feel Great, and Look Years Younger. Coming up, we'll continue Wellness Wednesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Council for Older Adults of Delaware County, helping to provide compassionate in-home care for older loved ones. Its mission is to help older people live safely at home and avoid unnecessary institutional care. More at growingolder.org.
You can discover more about WOSU Public Media by signing up for our WOSU FYI e-newsletter. Once you sign up, you'll receive a bi-weekly arts and culture e-newsletter featuring program highlights from radio and television, special event information, ticket offers, and much more. Just visit wosu.org/email to sign up.
Support comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Prescription drug overdoses have skyrocketed since 1999, especially among women, according to the results of an 11-year study released last week by the Centers for Disease Control. The CDC found that these overdoses kill four times as many women as cocaine and heroin combined. Now, it may be that the incidence of cocaine and heroin overdoses has decreased, but those rates are mirrored in Ohio, where several counties are home to so-called pill mills, where prescriptions are dished out with little consultation. Joining me now by phone to talk about what law enforcement is doing about it at the state level is Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Ann, good to be back. Thank you very much.
Did these new statistics, did this latest rash of statistics surprise you?
Well, a caveat to start with. My understanding is these statistics do not include 2012.
Right.
So although we do have interesting statistics, anecdotally, a few counties for 2012, you know, to take our listeners back, you know, when I took office a couple of years ago, you know, we really started focusing, and the governor did, and everybody did, really, on the prescription drug problem. And, you know, I think we have seen some good results, particularly in some of the counties in southern Ohio where it was really an epidemic. Scioto County, for example, has actually seen a drop last year in the number of deaths because of prescription drugs. So that's good news. Hamilton County, on the other hand, for whatever reason, there's an increase. So it's a continuing battle. You know, what we have done that I think is the most effective, one, the legislature passed a bill that makes it much easier for us to eliminate a lot of the pill mills around the state, and that has been done. Second, we've really gone after the bad doctors. And, you know, most doctors do a great job, but there was a few out there that were just nothing but drug dealers. So we've taken down actually license revocations of 31 doctors and 10 pharmacists over the last couple of years. And that's a real big deal. I mean, we had one, just to give you an example, a doctor down in in Scioto County when we conducted the raid down there, and I went on the raid. You know, he'd seen 45 patients, I think, by 11:15 that morning. And when I walked in, there was no nurse, there was no receptionist, there was no medical books that I could see. He's just sitting at a desk with, a pad to write prescriptions. He had, I think, 8 or 9 other offices around the state, and he just kind of rode the circuit. So we've gone after these individuals, and I think we're beginning to see a real change. One of the things that you noted at the beginning about the impact on women, I think because prescription drugs are, quote, legal, even though 2/3 of the people who die of an overdose of prescription drugs, it wasn't their own prescription. But because initially they're prescribed legally, I think some of the stigma connected with heroin, for example, does not attach to the prescription drugs, and people fool themselves and think, well, it's legal, it's prescribed, I can use these. And I think that's one of the reasons that you find it's so insidious in regard to women. It cuts across every economic boundary.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike some of the other drugs that we historically have thought, are focused more in urban areas, what we find with the prescription drug abuse is it's probably more prevalent in rural areas. It's more prevalent in Appalachia, part of the state of Ohio. So it just is really, really a huge, huge problem. If you look at the overall problem, if someone asked me, what's the drug problem in Ohio? I'd say, look, heroin and prescription drugs to start with, and then we can go from there. There are a lot of other things that are a problem, but heroin has dramatically changed as far as its prevalency and its cost. It's more prevalent. It's in every county, and it's cheap.
You launched a prescription drop box program late last year where people can discard unneeded medications. What was the goal of that program, and how's it doing?
Well, it's going well. I mean, we have 67 prescription drug boxes that were sent to Southern Ohio law enforcement agencies. But this part of an overall trying to culture change. I mean, it's not just the drugs that are dropped off. We're trying to get, all of us, and I say all of us, myself included, to understand that we can't have drugs hang around our house. When they get old, get rid of them. And people wonder, well, how do I get rid of them? And these drop boxes are a convenient way to do it. The DEA also, a couple times a year, holds in Columbus and other cities. They partner with Kroger's and other places. And you just can drive by and literally hand it to the police officer and you get rid of them. But what we're trying to do is get people to understand that having these drugs around the house is a danger. Kids can get it. Grandkids can get them. We do know that people, their homes listed, for example, for sale. Addicts will go in. They'll pretend like they're looking at the house. They'll slip in the bathroom and they'll rip off every drug they can
find. Attorneys General to urge the Food and Drug Administration to adopt standards requiring manufacturers and marketers of generic prescription painkillers to develop tamper and abuse-resistant versions of their products. First of all, I wondered, why just generic manufacturers? And can drugs be made more difficult to abuse? I mean, if you pop a pill, is there something you can do to it that makes it less liable to be abused?
Well, they work on that. I mean, this is a small item, but it's just part of the overall effort that we don't want accidentally some kid getting in there and getting a Percocet or something that will, very well could. So it's part of the overall effort. A lot of the, generic drugs do not do this for whatever reason. I suppose it's a cost issue, but doesn't cost that much. And, if you save a life, it's very important.
Okay. Well, Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Good to be with you again.
Appreciate it. Thanks. Joining us now in the studio is Paul Coleman. He is president and CEO of Maryhaven Addiction Treatment Center.
Actually, Ann, we're a full-service behavioral health care provider, but our specialty and our 60-year history is in addiction recovery care.
So Addiction Treatment Center, that's not part of your title.
No, it's not.
Right. Paul Coleman, your president of Mary Haven, one of CDC's findings was that women have been catching up to men in terms of prescription overdoses. Any idea why that is? Is it akin to what Attorney General Mike DeWine was talking about?
I think the Attorney General had some of the factors. I think a major factor, though, in the beginning of a course of addiction that starts with legitimately prescribed drugs is actually in the nature of the physician-patient encounter, whether that patient is male or female. What we have had now for the past 10 to 15 years are very powerful medicines to treat pain. And if they are not used as prescribed, they can pose very serious dangers to the patient. I think the patient should always ask his or her physician if they go to seek help for pain or seek help for depression or something like that. When they get a prescription, they should ask, is this the least aggressive intervention we can start with? I think most physicians, as the Attorney General said, are scrupulous in terms of prescribing, and they don't want to overprescribe.
Mm-hmm.
But once a patient starts on these very powerful medications, it can be a problem for them if they don't watch themselves.
But what's the deal with women?
Women, I think, tend to seek the healthcare encounter a little bit more than men. Men will sort of decide to tough it out. Also, frankly, the incidence and prevalence of depressive illness in women is higher than it is in men, and I think that may bring more women into the initial encounter where they get the prescription
or
drug.
Or women are more likely to seek treatment for depression and
exactly.
other mental illnesses.
Exactly.
The same way women are more likely to seek treatment for a bad back or
exactly.
sore knees. Okay.
Exactly.
Have you seen more women seeking treatment at Mary Haven for addiction to prescription medications?
And we have. In fact, most of our women patients at Mary Haven tell us that they got started on a course of addiction to opiates through pain medication, mostly legitimately prescribed. Some of our other patients will tell us that they've been engaged in a course of addictive illness for some time, and the latest thing, of course, is synthetic opiates like OxyContin and Vicodin. And, of course, as the Attorney General said, the incidence and prevalence and relative inexpensive nature of heroin is a huge problem in our state.
I gather that it's rare that someone just overdoses on one drug, but that drug interactions are responsible often. Are women more likely to be on a number of drugs? Is that what you've seen, is that these overdosing issues where people are dying is because of a combination?
I think drug interaction is always a factor, and it is more likely to present itself among women patients. The other thing, of course, is that women patients tend, as a general rule, to weigh less and have different body chemistry than men patients, and therefore a mistake in taking a drug, which could be just an overdose in a larger man, may prove fatal in a woman who is not quite that size.
I get what you're saying about most doctors take great pains to diagnose and treat with these strong medications very sparingly. How well do you think they do a job of explaining the dangers of the medication to the patients when they prescribe them and making sure that they know, if you're having a problem getting off this drug, come back to me, I'll help you, we'll work on it?
I think the vast majority of physicians do that and do it well. I think the problem sometimes occurs, and a typical patient story at Mary Haven is that I hurt my back, I went to the doctor prescribed me some pills, I found out they worked very well, so I asked the doctor for some more, and maybe he or she refilled it once or twice, and then he or she told me, I think we need to wean you down. And I didn't want to wean down, so I found another doctor. And then that goes on for a while, and then someone tells them, hey, you know, you can buy these pills on the street. And finally, when that becomes too expensive, Anne, finally the patient will turn to heroin, which is much less expensive. And then finally, they come to Mary Haven for help. And I have had patients tell me who started out on legitimate prescriptions, I never thought I'd end up putting a needle in my arm.
But shouldn't doctors, when they have a patient that calls up and says, I want another refill, and they say, nah, it's time to wean you, and they don't call back, they don't come to get weaned off a drug, shouldn't that be a red flag to physicians that they're shopping out there and their follow-up is important?
I think it should be, and I think that it's part of the regulatory and legal scheme here in Ohio through the Ohio Board of Pharmacy. We do have a centralized prescription data bank where you can track who is getting what prescription from one. And that, I think, is very helpful. That's why you will find, and many of our patients at Mary Haven tell us this, we couldn't get it through prescription anymore, so we found it on the streets. Now, through the good work of Attorney General Devine, certainly Governor Kasich, and the Ohio General Assembly, we've tightened up the supply of synthetic opiates, like, again, OxyContin and Vicodin.
Mm-hmm.
So what you find then is that a person who is in active addictive illness will turn to other similar drugs. And that, of course, is heroin, which is in rampant use here in Ohio.
Plenty around.
Plenty
it's
around
cheap.
And very inexpensive.
Is heroin a painkiller?
Heroin can be used.
You know,
it and in fact, historically, has been used as a painkiller. And what the synthetic drugs, the prescription drugs we're talking about, are all synthetic versions of heroin.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
So when someone comes to Mary Haven with this kind of addiction, how do they usually get there? Because they've hit rock bottom, or they've been incarcerated, you know, they've been arrested. What's the usual entry level, and does that dictate how well they're going to be able to recover?
Well, patient compliance, as to the last part of your question, is essential in any area of health care, whether it's behavioral health care, which we do at Mary Haven, or primary health care, which other practitioners do. So the patient has to want to get better. The patient has to want to be compliant. What we do at Mary Haven is we provide a combination of medication-assisted therapy to help people safely withdraw from heroin and other opiates, and also to comfortably withdraw, because if a patient isn't comfortable, he or she will leave treatment. We use that along with cognitive behavioral therapy, group education, and our success generally does depend on how engaged the patient is.
Getting back to the standards that the Food and Drug Administration could require manufacturers to adopt regarding not just tampering. I get the tamper thing, so you can't open the bottle really easily and all that kind of stuff. But are there abuse-resistant versions of these products out there? And so there's an abuse-resistant OxyContin, so it's harder to abuse. And how does that work?
Well, it works in that the dosage would be self-contained in the pill. And if you would crush the pill or grind the pill up and try and ingest it through inhaling it, it would not work. There really isn't anything that can be done in terms of the formulary of the drug to prevent someone from taking three when they should take one, or even taking one when they should take none.
And what do we know about how many of these deaths might be suicidal?
That's a good question. It's a question, I think, for the coroner. And the coroner, Dr. Jan Gorniak, is on our board of directors at Mary Haven. I've talked with her several times about this. Sometimes it is very difficult to tell. As I understand it, the general rule is absent a note it is hard to declare this a suicide.
Okay. Well, Paul Coleman, President and CEO of Mary Haven, thanks for joining us again. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for having us on.
Coming up when we return, more Wellness Wednesday. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from On the Square Yoga, offering 45-minute midday yoga classes at 11, noon, and 1 in downtown Columbus. On the Square Yoga, located at 65 East State Street between the Ohio Theater and the Sheraton, making yoga accessible to everybody. More at onthesquareyoga.com.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Alfredo Corchado, who spent years covering the violence of drug cartels in Mexico. Once at a restaurant in Laredo, Texas, two young men came in with a warning.
One of them takes his hand out and points at me and does like he was using a gun. Bam, bam, bam.
Corchado's new memoir is called Midnight in Mexico. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from the Homeport Noble on Long Condominiums, offering home ownership opportunities in the King Lincoln District, featuring a diverse community with a mix of historic and newly built homes and condos. Details at homeportohio.org/NOBO on Long.
You're mobile and we are too. Now you can get 89.7 NPR News anytime, anywhere with the free WOSU Public Media mobile app. It features live audio streaming, news stories on demand, and podcasts of your favorite shows. Just go to wosu.org/mobile app and download the app today.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. An end-of-life medical directive is a sort of thing most of us put off until it's too late. According to the American Medical Association, less than one quarter of Americans have recorded their end-of-life wishes, but 30% of us will require someone else to make decisions on our behalf in the end. Without someone appointed to make those decisions or an end-of-life directive that's easy to find and understand, you face the possibility of receiving thousands of dollars worth of unwanted medical care on your deathbed and untold anxiety and stress. Our next guests have developed a process to ease the burden on everyone, doctors, patients, and families, and it's paperless. Joining us now by phone to tell us more are two of three co-founders of True North Healthcare. It's an online platform for recording and sharing healthcare proxies. Azalea Kim will earn her MD from the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in 2014. Welcome to the show, Azalea.
Hi, Ann. Thanks so much for having us on.
And Margaret Terry, she's worked with Bain & Company in Chicago, where she consulted in the medical devices, pharmaceutical distribution, and third-party insurance administration. Welcome to the show, Margaret. Hello, Margaret. Well, we'll try to work on Margaret.
Hi.
Oh, hi, Margaret. Are you there?
Hi, yes. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, you bet. All right. So is True North, let's start with Azalea. Is True North an app? How does it work? What are we talking about here?
Well, I guess first, True North, when we say True North, we mean it's our patient is our guiding star. So this is the, it is a two-sided web-based platform that on the one side, as you said, patients can create, update, and share those two important forms, the healthcare proxy, the person who can legally make medical decisions for them on their behalf if they're too sick to make them for themselves, mm-hmm. and their living will, which would be their preferences or wishes for the kind of care they would want. On the other side of the platform, which is a cloud-based platform, we have providers who are now able to see this information. It's a really important data, where and when they're needed in the emergency room, in the hospital, at point of care. And we do this through working with providers to integrate them seamlessly into electronic medical record platforms. As you know, there's a lot of different options out there where different providers are using different platforms, and they don't speak to each other. So we're dealing with an issue where currently they're done a lot on paper. If they are done on paper, they're scanned into a system, and those systems don't all talk to each other. And True North kind of sits above all this, mediating between all everyone involved.
How do you do that when they're not talking to each other? How does True North achieve that?
So, and I think this is the critical, important question about integration, how do you actually achieve this? And different states are trying to tackle this problem themselves, where they see that it's compromising patient care to have such a fragmentation across our system.
Mm-hmm.
We are a cloud-based platform, so we have a single source of truth coming from our patients.
Okay.
And there are integration partners that we're working with who have mechanisms to which we can sync with EMRs to make this data available in real time. And that is our goal, where you, for instance, I was in the emergency room yesterday. When I click through a patient's note, I can click on a tab. In this particular hospital, we use Epic. There is a tab for this. It's just often empty. And so our mechanism would allow for either a link or some way for our data to be able to sync in.
Okay, so would that work for a hospital that I've never been to before? Let's say I have a critical illness. I go out of town for a day. I get sick there. I'm in another hospital in another place. Is it going to work the same way?
Will it work the same way? Unlikely, in the sense that our initial test run through our pilots, and we have some interesting pilots partner in actually Dayton, Ohio. I'm originally from New York, but I'm learning a lot about Ohio now.
Mm-hmm.
And in that particular population of people, it makes most sense to work with the doctors and hospitals they are most likely to visit. But because we're a cloud-based solution, and we've now activated you and your family members who maybe have a shared copy of your proxy forms,
mm-hmm.
it makes total sense for, one, you to be able to access your form and bring it in yourself, and two, for a physician there who knows about this platform, maybe they haven't had the opportunity to have their hospital plugged in,
mm-hmm.
They would still be able to access this via the cloud, and that's kind of the great thing about...
If they know it exists.
If they know it exists.
Yeah, okay. So when you're filling out the form online... Does it help you make decisions like how to figure out who would be the good power of attorney or, who would be your proxy and that sort of thing, how to decide those things? Margaret Terry?
Oh, sure. Yes. So we absolutely have some very, I would say, basic FAQ and guidance. So helping people pick who's the right person for the proxy. There are some very standard and accepted guidelines as to who could be a good person and who would not be the best person to serve that role. That said, we recognize that there are actually a lot of wonderful educational efforts going on right now to inform patients of the best way to have these conversations, and
mm-hmm.
we're really not trying to replace those efforts at all. We actually see ourselves as a complementary tool that can really connect all of those great efforts with decisions that are being made by doctors in the hospital today, every day.
Yeah, we've done a show on the documentary Start the Conversation before. Just having the conversation is a tough thing for a lot of people to do. That's why they don't do this in the first place. What inspired you to start this platform for end-of-life decisions, and why do you think it'll be easier for people to do it this way than the paper way?
What inspired us to start down this path is that we felt that we had seen time and time again in the hospital setting that patients don't reliably have a voice in their care. And for me, it was a very personal and sad experience taking care of a 60-year-old woman with terminal cancer. She was admitted to our hospital and had a complicated social situation, so didn't have her family or friends available. And despite a really complicated course of illness, so our electronic medical record was extensive, there was no healthcare proxy form there.
Mm-hmm.
And so our team did what any other medical team would do in this country, which we did everything. We ordered all the tests, all the imaging, and even invasive procedures. And in 48 hours, she passed away, and I couldn't help but think, mm-hmm. you know, for those months after, if this was really how she would have wanted to spend the last few days of her life. So for us, it's a very personal mission, and we want to find that technology that can bridge the gap. We know that 25% of people are doing this on paper, and even if they are having this conversation, let's say it's with their primary care doc, with their family, or with their lawyer, that's not making its way into the hospital setting. And in this situation, this woman had probably many opportunities or should have had this conversation. And to the extent that our tool can enable that conversation to happen, that is what our goal would be for that person who hasn't had it done.
There are a couple of other startups using technology to help with end-of-life decisions, like My Directives and EverPlans. How is True North different or alike in those cases? I don't know who to ask which one, Margaret Terry.
Sure. No, I'll jump in here. So we do think we're doing some of the same things as those folks, and we're just sort of doing it in different geographies. So We started this as a business at Harvard Business School. That's actually where the three of us met, and we just graduated last month. And as Adelia mentioned, she's in New York. So we've been really working on this in the Northeast. And we recognize, at least we've spoken with my directives, and they're more in the Texas and Southern region right now. We do think that it's a similar product, and we're really happy that so many other people are excited to tackle this problem because, frankly, we don't think there are enough people worrying about it.
And I would just add on to that, I think the evidence in the medical literature has shown that it takes a village to make this work. And the most successful efforts over at La Crosse, Wisconsin, with Gunderson Lutheran, it is an activated patient population, an activated provider group that wants this all to happen so that the conversation starts at one end and they're honored and respected at the other end. And our platform really focuses on having those champion provider partners and community activists to make this work together in one system rather than going the direct-to-consumer or kind of spreading, getting as many users on board, which is kind of, I think, how a lot of tech startups go, where though we can get so many users on board. It's a two-sided platform, and there's network effects. So it's only the system's only as good as many people are on the other side that also feel the same way. So we've had a very strategic approach in thinking about how this actually plays out in the real world, in the real hospital setting.
You said that having an end-of-life plan can end up saving a lot of money, and a lot of people don't like to talk about it. That's where all of the, you know, worry about the issue of end-of-life conversations with doctors being covered by insurance in the Obamacare plan raised the hackles of so many people. They called them death, I don't know, I can't even remember, death panels. And but saving money at the end of life is not an insignificant thing. When you talk about the 60-year-old woman or the 60-ish woman that you referred to earlier, Azalea, someone spent a lot of money to do something that maybe she didn't want.
Yes, and I think that's, we've always said this is not about rationing care. This is about aggressive, unwanted care.
Mm-hmm.
The politicization has led people to think that we're restricting care, but really we're giving people the opportunity to say, maybe I do want everything. And that's great too, because the literature actually tells us that the savings is not just in restricting care. It's having that conversation and thinking through what it is you would reasonably want, because most people actually don't want absolutely everything. So we've always pitched ourselves as a patient advocacy and your healthcare proxy advocacy tool. And that would be the most important takeaway for us.
I haven't done one of these things before, so I wonder, how do you decide what you want and don't want? How do you know what might the options be? And, you know, with medical technology changing as fast as it is, and we know it is, the options could change in just a matter of years.
You're absolutely right. And we look at this as a kind of an iterative conversation, that once you've created this relationship with someone virtually, you can make updates to how you feel about different interventions. Let's say when you're very healthy, you might want a different set of interventions versus later on. But also, I think more importantly, we've had a wonderful group of mentors who've been doing this for a long time. And sometimes it's not the question of, do you do not want a breathing tube?
Mm-hmm.
It's the question of what's really important to you, what makes your life worth living, what makes you happy in a day, and what would be upsetting. And that kind of initiating that kind of conversation might be more productive in figuring out what is the most appropriate treatment when that time comes.
Margaret, have you done this? Have your families done this? You have a couple of pilots going on. Who's doing it, and how are you getting people involved in the pilots?
Sure. So I have had this conversation with my loved ones. And in terms of pilots, I'm happy to say yesterday I actually gave a kickoff presentation at a senior living facility that we're working with here in the Massachusetts area. And we are launching our first feasibility studies there next week. And we'll be working with seniors to understand really how useful the platform is that we've built to date. We understand that as younger users, we grew up using, smartphones and laptops. And
mm-hmm.
So what we think would make a good website, maybe not what, my grandmother would think is a great website and what would work for her. So that's what we're doing right now. And as Azalea mentioned, we're also excited about a pilot that we're launching soon in Dayton, Ohio at the Hospice of Dayton.
Is your target right now pretty much the baby boom generation?
Yeah, I think we've always thought that in order to reach patients who are activated, and by that I mean who are ready to think about this, because as you mentioned, it's hard to even think about when you're healthy, and we think there's so much good to be done that starting with those who are more likely to have the conversation is the way to go. And so although we do believe that really everyone, when you turn 18, you should this should be something that everyone has thought about, mm-hmm. because God forbid, you know, accidents do happen. But we believe that starting there is the way to go. And so I would say the ages of 50 to 65 and then over 65 have been our focus.
Okay. And what has been the response from people when you query them? What has your research shown about their willingness to participate?
I guess the best story I have is the senior center director over at Charlestown, Massachusetts. She's quite a firecracker. Her name's Beverly Gibbons. She's doing this 25 years. And for her, it's been a difficult conversation for her to initiate with her children who are living outside of Massachusetts and to have that conversation. But also, she's been the healthcare proxy now for several residents and other individuals in the community. And for her, her reaction has been like, I find it really difficult when I go into the hospital as not someone who isn't a blood relative to say that I'm the healthcare proxy and I understand this person's wishes. And she has told us that it feels like a very empowered feeling, and that it's something that she feels can translate now to her loved ones who can also be part of this platform when it comes to her wishes. So that was probably one of the best feedbacks we've gotten, because it's from someone who's been on both sides.
Do you see an opportunity, whether it is True North Healthcare or the other startups, My Directives and Everplans and others that will start up? Is there a foothold that you can get in Obamacare, in the new national healthcare coverage program that eventually will roll out and has to a certain extent already? Margaret?
Yes, hopefully so. So I actually worked for the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation last summer between my 2 years in business school, and I worked on a lot of the innovation grants there, and I worked on an end-stage renal disease model demonstration. So I am familiar with the way that Obamacare has been operationalized, at least so far.
Mm-hmm.
I think that moving with Medicare would be really great, and I think that combining efforts is really the ultimate goal. And we would be really excited to talk to them about that opportunity.
Medicare and Medicaid for that matter, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, I just want to thank my guests, Azalea Kim and Margaret Terry. They are part of a trio who have developed a new application to help people make end-of-life wishes store it in the cloud for others to use when the time comes. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Ann.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.